This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Just imagine us with that big huh emoji on our faces right now.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Tom Talk. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mike.
For those of you that somehow don't know, Tom is the director of Future Ed. And also joining us, as always, my co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you both here with me. You know, I got to see Tom last week at the Pi Network Summit. This is the big gathering for education reform advocacy groups from around the country. I know it was my first conference in a year and a half. I think maybe yours as well, Tom.
It was. The last big gathering I was at was a PiNet conference as well at the end of February 2020. Little did we know.
That was mine as well. I remember that one was in Miami, and we all wondered afterwards if we had people gotten COVID there before we knew what was happening. This one in Denver, it was just so great to be with people again. I mean, first of all, just to leave my house, but then to also see folks and the energy, which was fantastic. And, you know, Tom, you gave me a ride from the airport to the hotel on Lyft. So I owe you for that. And now I owe you for coming on the podcast as well. So,
well, it's my pleasure.
All right. Well, Tom, we have asked you onto the show to talk about some of your recent work focusing on what the District of Columbia Public Schools is doing around teacher diversity and quality. Let's talk about that on Ed Reform Update. All right, Tom. Well, first of all, can I say I just so appreciate that you have stayed on the case with DC education reform. I feel like for many people, that was like so 2010s. And, you know, as we don't have any attention span, we're on to the next shiny object. Of course, we're all dealing with this terrible crisis with the pandemic. But even so, you know, we're always on to new issues. And here you are doggedly reminding us that what is happening in DC is pretty incredible. And a big part of that story is what they're doing around teachers. So just tell us a little bit, what is it that DC Public Schools has been doing? And why do you think it's such a model for other places?
Right. Well, it was for a long time one of the most dysfunctional urban districts in the country pre the Michelle Rhee Kai Henderson reform era. And while those reforms did focus on the teaching profession, the district has stayed the course and really expanded its work into curriculum and instruction and professional development and the like. And it is, however, a model, I think, for the country about how to create a human capital system that is performance-based and rewards success. And our most recent report focuses on teacher hiring and the district's decision to create a more comprehensive, multi-step system for vetting teachers that is quite different than what we see in many districts that use the folding chair on Saturday in the gym in late August strategy of onboarding new people. The district has created an evidence-based, research-based system that includes not only interviews, but essay questions, videos of teachers at work, comprehensive interviews by other teachers in the district that have demonstrated their own proficiency over the years. And then layered on top of all that, an opportunity for individual schools with principals working with teams of teachers to do additional vetting. And the results have been quite impressive. They get better people, they get them earlier in the hiring cycle, and by bringing people on earlier in the annual hiring cycle, they get better people. And I should say that a key component of this sophisticated hiring system is DC's controversial, longtime controversial teacher evaluation system that allows officials in the district to see who does well once they get in the classroom. And they have demonstrated that teachers who are hired earlier and teachers who have been most successful in this multi-step vetting system are in fact better once they get in the classroom. And it's not clear to me why a lot more school districts couldn't and don't do this.
Yeah, no. Well, so let's talk about that. But let's hear about the common things you may hear from other school districts, right? First of all, they'd say, well, look, DC Public Schools pays really well, right? DC spends a ton of money. I mean, depending who you ask or what data you look at, you know, $20,000, $25,000 per kid. There's just so much money here. And so the teachers get paid very well. You can be, I think, just a few years into your career at DC. And if you're doing great, you could be making six figures. So that's one thing. And so these other districts say, look, we use these other strategies because we can't get anybody to apply, you know, or we're scrounging around. And that's because of our low salary. So what would you say to that?
Yeah, well, the key to what you just said is it pays more to those who are doing a great job. Most school districts don't have a performance-based compensation system, and they don't incentivize teachers to work in their toughest schools the way DCPS does. You can earn $25,000 a year on top of your regular salary if you are an outstanding, a highly effective teacher working in the city's toughest schools. That's a smart strategy that most school districts don't use. So it's not like everybody's making a ton of money. It's the people who have demonstrated that they're good teachers, outstanding teachers, and willing to work in tough environments that are making more money.
Yeah. No, all right. So that's fair. So in general, what else? I mean, this system, like, it sounds like, okay, you're pushing people through a rigorous process. But again, I mean, in the true time, you've got to have a big group of people interested in teaching in your system in the first place to make that work. And so, I mean, is there something other than the salaries that's drawing people into DC that other systems might be able to emulate?
Well, it's certainly the case that Washington, DC is a millennial magnet. It's easier to get bright young people to come to the nation's capital than it is to, say, the capital of Oklahoma. And that's an advantage. But the district also has established itself as a system that respects teachers, that gives them additional opportunities to grow professionally, to take on new roles and responsibilities, and to get compensated for that work. And it is a good place to be a teacher. On top of that, the district has been very aggressive in the best way, very sort of sophisticated. In recruitment, it goes after teachers of the year at all levels across the country. It works closely with a variety of local institutions of higher education, including Howard, AU, Georgetown, to develop pipeline programs for a variety of high needs positions, including teachers of color, math and science teachers, and bilingual teachers. So they've been smart in building a comprehensive system. It's not just, you know, the paycheck.
Yep. No, that makes a ton of sense. And the teacher diversity point is important. That's on a lot of people's minds right now. And, you know, by some measures, we seem to be doing even worse on that front in recent years.
Right.
DC has been bucking that trend.
DCPS has 15% of its teacher force being filled by Black men. That's more than three times the national average.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive. David, as a former teacher in DC, not DC Public Schools, but a charter school, what are your thoughts here? Think you would have maybe gone through this process back in the day if it had existed?
Yeah, you mean as a millennial who was hired in August? Yeah, I mean, I think it's a both-and situation, obviously, right? They do have money. It is a millennial magnet, and they are making the most of the situation insofar as they're able to do that. And I mean that sincerely. I'm curious just to hear more anecdotally or in a research sense, the number of good people you have to bring in, right, is partly a function of the number of good people that you manage to keep versus lose, right? And so, you know, if you lose people every year or two, you're quickly going to exhaust in everywhere except DC, probably, the supply of feckless millennials. This is one of those things that just drives me nuts. You know, just the absence of any real career ladder, right, in the education world. Do you think that they are successfully keeping high-performing people in the system by having something that approaches a career ladder?
For sure. They do pay people on the basis of their performance. So if you do a good job over a period of time and work in the most challenging environments, you're going to make over $100,000 a year. But built into that pay system or attached to it is a career ladder that allows teachers to take on a wide range of roles that represent professional opportunities, from evaluating new teachers to being coaches in schools to being curriculum directors to playing key roles in the school-based professional development system that the city has. And the result of this is that the city retains on an annual basis about 95% of its highly effective teachers and about 84-85% of its effective teachers. Some critics of these human capital reforms suggest that the overall attrition rate, which is about 25% and right in line with other urban districts, is really problematic and suggests that these reforms are not effective. But in fact, half of that turnover is among teachers who are annually fired for poor performance or who voluntarily leave when they are rated just above for a couple of years in a row the ineffective category. So there's a lot of voluntary attrition amongst weak teachers, which is a good thing. And the district does an outstanding job of keeping the vast majority, 95-96%, of its really highly effective teachers. To me, that's a testament of the success of the reforms.
No, definitely. And especially if over time, if they can feel like they're getting better with this hiring system at figuring out who is likely to be a great teacher. I mean, that has always been an enormous challenge. You know, a lot of us remember the Malcolm Gladwell article saying it's like figuring out who's going to be a great quarterback. It's just super hard. And that's why there's an argument for, you know, letting people try it and then culling folks after a couple of years if they're not good for it. But of course, that is an expensive strategy in terms of money and the impact it can have on kids who have to suffer through ineffective teachers. So if DC is actually getting better at spotting the great teachers and maybe figuring out who's not great, and so they never step foot in a classroom, that is a huge contribution as well that other places can learn a ton from.
Yeah, it just seems to me to be a really important development. I mean, I think Gladwell is wrong in this, or at least DCPS has proven that he's wrong, that you can actually go some significant distance towards identifying those who are going to be good and forego the challenges of having some number of kids exposed to weak teachers for 2 or 3 years until you decide, you know, in fact, that they are weak teachers and you get them out of the profession, as you say, Mike. So this is actually a pretty big deal when you think about the number of teachers we've got in public schools and across the country and the centrality of teachers to student success.
All right. Well, we will leave it there, Tom. Helpful stuff. Appreciate it. People can check out, remind us, let's see, this article that we are referring to, the most recent one, is in the 74, right? How DC's teacher hiring process is drawing a larger pool of high-quality candidates and diversifying the teaching core. Hey, by the way, we all need to tell our friends at the 74, shorter titles, people, shorter headlines. That is way too long.
And there's a longer version of the report on the Future Ed website if people want to go into more detail on the mechanics of the hiring system.
That is great. All right. Hey, Tom Talk, Director of Future Ed. Thanks so much.
See you guys.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. So I got to ask you, as another Gen Xer, do you understand what all the buzz about Dune is? I somehow missed, I guess, the movie the first time around. I never read the novel. What's up with Dune?
I will tell you. So I went to a private school and my ninth grade English teacher was so into Zoom. She made us read like the entire series. I hated it. Oh my gosh. I just so was not into it. But it's one of those examples where, you know, teachers have quite a bit of license in private schools and public, I think. But again, this was private. So we read a ton of Dune novels. It was painful for me. I'm sorry to report.
See, I didn't even know it was a series. It's not just one book. Now, David, you're some kind of Dune geek as well as just a geek. So tell us more about that.
How did you just intuit that? I don't know. I have also read the whole series. I can confirm that books 2 through 5 are terrible. I will defend the first book. I think it's an excellent book, Amber. I think you're maybe taking, I don't know.
Maybe as an adult, it would look different. But as a, 14-year-old, it was not too entertaining.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the main thing to know is that after you read it, you just wonder how George Lucas got away with it. It's basically Inside Out Star Wars, and it came first. I'm excited for the movie. I've heard good things from people I trust.
All right, well, we should all watch the new movie, and then we should discuss. Okay, but until then, we are going to discuss education research. What you got for us, Amber?
We have a new study out of the University of Missouri that examines the effects of teacher specialization on student outcomes in elementary schools. I've covered a similar study, so I just want to remind everybody that specialization in this case does not imply having a special certification or training. It simply means that teachers teach one or two subjects out of the four main subjects, which are math, reading, social studies, and science, versus three or four of those subjects, wherein they refer to those teachers as generalist. Instead of calling them specialist or generalist, I'm going to try to just say they teach more or fewer subjects whenever I can, since I think it's less confusing. But anyhow, as a bit of background, some research has shown that teacher effectiveness can vary across subjects, and that teaching more subjects also increases preparation time and could hamper effectiveness. But we really don't have a ton of research on this topic. It's not decisive either way. So analysts use student and teacher administrative data from the Indiana Department of Education from the 2010-11 through 16-17 school years. They have standardized test scores in math and reading for grades 3 through 5 that they're using. Their sample includes roughly 15,000 to 17,000 unique math and reading teachers linked to close to 600,000 unique students. They employ multi-layer fixed effects models, grade, school, and year, with the key layer being teacher fixed effects. That basically means they compare the effectiveness of the same teachers in years when they taught more subjects and years when they taught fewer subjects. The design strengthens their model, but teachers who teach fewer or more subjects the whole time during their study period do not contribute to their estimates. Important to clarify, which this kind of got me in a pretzel. We can talk about it during the discussion point. But what they say is, unlike self-contained classrooms that enable teachers to cultivate relationships with kids by focusing on fewer students and spending more time with them, subject area specialization spreads teachers across more students. And again, we can loop back to it later because it wasn't clear to me whether they'd managed to separate the impact of self-containment. All right, back to that later. Their findings. They find that when a teacher teaches fewer subjects, one or two, their effectiveness in math is 0.04 standard deviation lower compared to when that same teacher teaches more subjects, three or four. The first year of teaching fewer subjects generates the largest negative impact, while the second and subsequent years are less negative. The patterns are the same for reading, though less pronounced. They examine whether the impacts vary by subgroup and find that the reduction in teacher effectiveness is greater for more vulnerable kids, including low achievers, students on free and reduced lunch, English language learners, and students with special needs. Then they look at the role of teacher specialization at the school level, not individual teacher level, and they find that it's not associated with school level math or reading achievement, nor does it have differing effects by school characteristics like, percentage of kids in poverty, minority students, and so on. They also find no evidence that specialization affects school level absences or disciplinary outcomes. So then there's this section of the paper where they say, okay, maybe specialization isn't working so well because principals don't know how to determine which teachers should specialize in which subjects. And they say this because, oddly enough, they also find that teachers with lower value-added scores and those considered not qualified by the Indiana DOE are more likely to specialize or teach one or two subjects. So I started thinking, well, that's kind of interesting because in my own teaching background, I sometimes just anecdotally saw that teachers who struggled more seemed to be given fewer preps. So have no idea whether that's going on or not. They also have a theory that teaching fewer subjects to more kids is bad for relationship building, which again, a little bit confusing to me with the self-contained bit, but the last thing they do is they see if the negative effects are reduced if the students are assigned to the same specialist for 2 years. And they do see that when they have that same teacher, those negative effects, at least in math, are reduced. So maybe there's something to that. But what was confusing again was that they saw no evidence that teaching fewer classes impacts absences or disciplinary outcomes. So that seemed to throw water on the whole relationship building thing for me. Anyhow, that's what I've got. Lots to dig in here and discuss.
Well, first of all, let's do a shout out to the authors. A friend of Fordham, Brian Casita, right? One of the authors, and his colleague, Na Young Huang. So, you know, we know Brian. He does good work. We're thinking this is pretty thoughtful. Also to say that, you know, this idea has been pinging around for a while to say, hey, in elementary school, you know, if some teachers are better at teaching reading and writing and other teachers are better at teaching math, if you let them specialize or departmentalize, some people say, then that should boost student achievement. That was in a paper by Brian Jacob and Jonah Rockoff about 10 years ago from Brookings, the Hamilton Project. I thought it was pretty compelling back then. And, you know, when we started, for example, looking at advice to school districts this year about how to help kids catch up from the pandemic, we were getting ready to make that suggestion. And a lot of practitioners said, no, there's now some evidence saying that departmentalization hurts. So I don't know, it seems like it should help just from a mathematical perspective, right? Everybody teaches their strongest subject twice a day instead of once. That should help, but it doesn't for some reason. In fact, it might even hurt. So I don't know. I mean, the relationship thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you buy that?
Well, sure. I mean, look, you know, again, we're talking about elementary schools, right? So we're talking about having relationships now with 50 kids, maybe instead of 25. Yeah, I can buy that that could make a difference. But it could also be that, you know, as you're saying here, you know, we don't really know how the schools are deciding which teacher teaches what, and maybe they're not following Jonah and Brian's suggestions from 10 years ago that they identify who's got the relative strengths, right? I mean, maybe they're just assigning teachers to the wrong subject. I don't know. David, what do you think?
Well, let me start with a quick question. When we say specialization, maybe I missed this. I mean, are we talking about differentiating between like math and science versus ELA and social studies?
Yeah, they don't do that. They don't do that. They say you're just teaching one or two subjects out of the four.
But that's probably right. I mean, I will say right now, my fifth grader, they're doing it for the first time in fifth grade in his school. And yeah, they group math and science together and they group
and reading and
ELA
social
and social studies together. I suspect that's pretty common. And so, you know, he's got one teacher for each of those. And that means that those teachers teach, you know, teach those subjects twice a day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It seems like an important point because I have a little bit of personal perspective on this. I did attend two different elementary schools, one of which basically either had you with the kids all day through third grade or split it, you know, like we were just saying, between two teachers in fourth and fifth grade. The other of which basically had you go from one teacher to the next in fifth grade like you would in high school. And I will say, I mean, the relationship building thing is real. Like, there's no comparison in terms of the kind of relationships that I came away from those experiences with. So I can definitely see how it could go too far in one direction. But I am wondering about, I knew my humanities teacher pretty darn well after, you know, after a year of spending half a day with them. That seems like a strong relationship to me. So I don't know. I mean, I guess my sense is that there could be a sweet spot here. I do think it's asking a lot of elementary teachers to ask them to be, you know, proficient, even in a basic way, because teaching is, as we all know, is a lot harder than it looks, to be proficient in the pedagogy of math and writing and reading. And I mean, that is asking a lot. If you're
And I don't think they get the training to be that, you know, qualified in the traditional prep program.
Right. Even with training, that strikes me as an extremely big ask. And I'm incredibly skeptical that they'll get the training. So, I mean, I still am of the opinion that once they kind of reach maybe third or fourth or fifth grade, that it does make sense to at least split it in two. But I can see the case for not going beyond that. And yeah, I don't really know what to say. I mean, I was nodding my head until you got to that bit about referrals, right?
Right. Why wouldn't we see that, right? Like, if you want to look at an outcome relative to relationship building, you would think attendance and disciplinary outcomes would be the right outcomes, you know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it just doesn't, I don't know, maybe it just doesn't manifest, right? Like, I mean, maybe kids skip for, you know, even if they
like their
strong relationships, right? And their relationships are strong on the days when they show up. Hard to say, but overall, I found the rest of it pretty intuitive. I mean, it's important, right? This strikes me as a really important question. I'm glad we're getting evidence on it. And I'm a little, as usual, dismayed that it seems to be so conflicting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess the last thing I'd say is that these negative impacts they saw, especially in math, I mean, are they relatively small? Is that
0.04 standard deviation lower compared to teaching more? So, yeah.
Pretty small. So, I don't know. It's not like, by all means, don't ever try this approach, you know, ever. But it's disappointing to me that it's also not positive because I would think it would have been.
So. Yeah, I'm surprised it showed up in math, too. That's a little weird.
All right. Well, we are flummoxed.
Well, in reading, too, just not pronounced. Anyway.
And reading, just even smaller in reading. Right. All right. Well, there you have it. Things that make you go, huh. Well, that's right. It. Just imagine us with that big, huh, emoji on our faces right now. Listen to them, and that's us. All right. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.